having a level of comfort in having uncomfortable conversations is a challenge for all of us. I don't know anybody in their mind who loves having complicated, challenging, uncomfortable conversations, right? Very few people like that kind of a dynamic. But the way you approach the conversations and the way that you choose your words and the way that you actively listen speaks volumes to how you can be perceived as a leader.
Hi, I'm Christine Shaw, CEO and President of Naylor Association Solutions, and I'm your host of the Association Advisor Podcast. We'll learn from successful association executives, partners, and clients on how to create a thriving, prosperous, and value-driven association. I invite you to join me in keeping informed and, most importantly, keeping your association profitable. Our goal is to leave you feeling inspired, more confident, and more knowledgeable. This is the Association Advisor Podcast. Welcome to the Association Advisor Podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. I'm your host, Christine Shaw. The job of an association CEO isn't what it used to be. Today's leaders must navigate political pressures, respond to crisis, and adapt to new technologies. Throughout it all, they must ensure members feel supported. Our guest today, Larry Sloan, CEO of the American Industrial Hygiene Association, knows this reality well. His role has shifted from focusing on member services to becoming a visible advocate in Washington and a steady guide for his team in times of uncertainty. What makes Larry's leadership stand out is how he integrates emotional intelligence into everything he does, from processing stakeholder feedback to leading with calm when the pressure is on. In this conversation, we'll explore why advocacy is more important than ever and how emotional intelligence can make the difference between simply reacting and truly leading. Larry, welcome to the Association Advisor Podcast. I am so excited to have you as a guest here today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is a couple times now we've been on these types of formats together, and you always have incredible insights. I really want to get into today the role of an association CEO. As you know, it's changed dramatically in recent years. So I'd like you to tell our listeners how you feel your role has evolved since you stepped into the CEO position at the American Industrial Hygiene Association.
Yeah, it's a great question to kick off. It has been a wild ride. I've been with AIG now for a little over 9 years. Wow. And I divide my tenure into eras, if you will. So there's the kind of pre-pandemic years when I was just getting started, getting to know the membership, getting to understand the dynamics of the association, the issues that are facing us. And then we entered the pandemic, and then we kind of came out of the pandemic, and now we're in Trump 2.0. And so as we were going into the pandemic, the association decided it needed to make a very big pivot and be more forward-facing with the general public. In other words, we knew at the beginning of the pandemic that COVID was just like any other workplace hazard. And we're experts at identifying the exposure to hazards. So we started developing this very common sense guidance to help small businesses reopen in those first few months of the pandemic. And we called it Back to Work Safely. Mm-hmm. So that was our foray into being more public facing. And then as we came out of the pandemic, we knew that we had to do more with respect to an issue like heat stress on the job, because the climate is changing and more workers are becoming exposed to higher temperatures. So we created and have now made available a free downloadable heat stress app for both outdoor and indoor workers.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was all kind of public facing material. And then with Trump 2.0, my job pivoted yet again. And now I've become very heavily focused, of course, on government affairs.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of lobbying. We're going to get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, and so let's stay really quickly. So during the pandemic, you all created a guidance, as you talked about, in some safety documents, and that also led to your first federal grant. Tell us a little bit about how that experience in particular shaped the way that you approach advocacy and impact in your role.
Yep. So again, in the beginning months of the pandemic, we created some 15 or so Back to Work Safely documents, each one tailored to a different industry sector. And we were working very closely with NIOSH at the time. And as a result of that collaboration, you know, NIOSH can't publish certain types of materials. So they rely on associations like AIJ to do that outward facing presence. Well, because of the work that we did behind the scenes with NIOSH, they were able to get us funding through the CDC.
I see.
The CDC had developed a series of these partnership agreements with nonprofits. And so we literally have just wrapped up a 5-year engagement with the CDC. And we realized over $800,000 in funding, which has enabled AIJ to develop a series of video vignettes, downloadable flyers, brochures, all freely available and all designed for the public to help employers better protect their workers in the face of any airborne transmitted disease, not limited to COVID.
That is
And I
amazing.
think that that experience helped us shape our advocacy with respect to what's been happening under the Trump administration. We have to change our narrative and really relate in terms of business forward and business sustainability. What is it that we're doing? We're protecting workers from getting sick. However, equally importantly, we're helping businesses become more sustainable and globally competitive. And I think that's the underlying theme to a lot of the lobbying and the advocacy that we've done since the end of the pandemic.
First of all, I love how you frame that you've looked at your tenure in errors, right? And each error comes with its own challenges. And just when you thought the pandemic was the most challenging, in comes Trump 2.0 for you, right? So talk a little bit about, in the role of a CEO for an association, the advocacy component and why it's so important that CEOs like yourself focus on advocacy and what that looks like.
So when I was first hired at AIHA, there was a turnover in the Director of Government Relations position. So I brought in my former director of GR. And unfortunately and coincidentally, he left the organization right at the beginning of 2025 as Trump was taking office. And so rather than quickly find a replacement for him, we decided to outsource our lobbying because we just didn't really know what the lay of the land was going to be like. We honestly didn't think that the RIFs, the reductions in force notices that were levied by DOGE, were actually going to impact any of the agencies that impacted or affected AIHA and our profession. And so when the RIFs were announced on April the 1st, we realized that we had to really step up our game. And it literally caused us to, within days, schedule meetings with members of Congress, their staff members, of course, and explain to folks, both in the House and the Senate, what is NIOSH? And that NIOSH is not part of OSHA. It's not a regulatory agency. It's a research institution that benefits workers across all different types of industries. And I got to tell you, Christine, it was a real wake-up call. And I think from now on, we as a profession need to do a much better proactive job in educating our policy makers and lawmakers, year after year after year on the fundamental reason why these different agencies exist and what the benefit is to the profession.
I think you're right. It's like the role of an association executive, it is very different and it's so expansive because, as we said in the intro, you're not just dealing with people stuff, technology stuff. I mean, the advocacy component has become so important, and that's how you also make sure you're representing your membership and their values and what they need from an association. So it's critical. I'm glad you talked through that.
And I would say that, it was actually a blessing that there was a gap, if you will, in this government relations position because it caused me, as the CEO of the organization, to really take an honest look at my role and say, I have to be the one to meet with these folks on Capitol Hill. And I had the backbone and the support of the contractor that we were using behind the scenes to help the arguments and help schedule the meetings, if you will. But my being the CEO, I think, really spoke very clearly that this is a very critical issue for the profession. And I've continued to have meetings, throughout the ensuing months, spring into early summer. And then, with the whole appropriations process, and when the House and the Senate each passed their fiscal 26 appropriations bills, we were actually quite happy because most all funding has been restored for the agencies that support our profession, including NIOSH. But then the government shut down. Now we're in limbo again.
So you're in limbo, and that's specific to the government shutdown. But going back to funding, you just said an important thing. You were able to get back some of your funding. But thinking about funding cuts, so talk a little bit about your experience there and how do you see associations stepping in to fill these gaps when this stuff happens or change the outcome as you did?
Very good question. So I don't have a clear-cut answer because we're kind of operating in this, and I hate the term new normal, but that's exactly what it is. And when the reduction in force notices were announced on April the 1st, the funding was still in place through fiscal 2025. Remember that continuing resolution was passed by Congress in March. And so we were arguing that bring the workers back, the funding is in place. If the workers are not in jobs, then the work can't get done. But those arguments fell on deaf ears. And so, as we worked our way through the spring, we did get a few hundred NIOSH workers back in response to a couple hearings where RFK Jr. was asked to defend why these decisions were made. And quite frankly, he had a really difficult time explaining any of the logic. So we got a
Yes.
few hundred NIOSH workers back in mid to late May. But then as we got into the midsummer, when the House and the Senate were doing their appropriations bills, we went actually over to HHS senior officials, which this is not territory that we typically navigate. We
Yeah.
never go to the executive branch. We never work with, and by the way, I found out who the contact at HHS was through a contact at the OMB. And so it was this kind of convoluted way of getting to the right person at HHS. And he and his lieutenants gave me 30 minutes to make our case. And he said, "Thank you very much, Larry. We appreciate your comments. We'll take this under advisement." But then when I followed up with him a couple weeks later, he used the argument that, well, there isn't a budget in place yet, so no comment. And now, of course, the government shut down.
Right.
So we don't know what's going to come out of all this. We're hoping that once the government reopens and the budget bills are approved for next year, or this fiscal year, I should say, we will know what's going to remain funded. If we find that certain programs within NIOSH are not funded, we will have to then adjust, and then we'll sit down with our board of directors to see where we can fill in the gaps.
Yeah, and so I think though throughout all that, I go back to what you're saying is without that gap of you having to lean in and do the advocacy and learn it yourself, you wouldn't even be where you are today. So while I know there's some uncertainty, the positive takeaway from this and what I think is transferable to other leaders in your shoes is getting into the details of what that looks like and being proactive because you're probably going to have influence on a more positive outcome than if you had not done any of that or just relied on an outside person or a consultant to do it, which is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I came from the Chemical Trade Association world, and so when I ran SACMA, which was an association of small, medium-sized specialty chemical companies, lobbying was a very important focus for the organization. So I was much more involved in government relations than I was when I came to AIHA. But I've enjoyed the experience. I mean, I really enjoy communicating the complexities of science to any type of an audience. And so you're right, it helped me really dig into the fundamentals. And through all of this, we've developed a great array of materials to help our members do grassroots advocacy on our behalf. When all of the risks were announced, we generated over 6,000 letters across our members to members of Congress advocating for the restoration of NIOSH. I'm very proud of that. And we really got a great, 5-star rating. When we had our annual meeting at the end of May, there was a lot of talk about NIOSH because that was only a couple months old at that point. And so we really felt very good about all the efforts that we had put in at that point and then thereafter. So it's been a great ride.
It's in your DNA, so to say.
It
No pun
is.
on the, So let's talk a little bit though about leadership skills. So we've talked about your areas of leadership. You talked a little bit too about what you went through with the pandemic, now Trump 2.0, the government shutdown. Tell us a little bit, or I would love for you to give some takeaways or advice to other association leaders like yourself, and what can they do or what should they know during periods of transition or challenges when they're dealing with it?
I mean, the old expression is change is inevitable, right? Every single day, something's going to change. And I think for a lot of us CEOs, the hardest part of the job, at least the hardest part of the job for me, is the dynamics of managing people. I love people. However, people are often complex and often act illogically. And so, amidst all of this chaos that we're dealing with as association leaders, whether it's advocacy or members complaining about something at the annual conference or whatever, any number of things. You have staff who have their own fears and anxieties, and that manifests itself in behaviors around the office. And it's made even more complex because we are not requiring our staff to come in specific days of the week. We still have a hybrid office. And so we're managing a lot of these conversations and dynamics with our staff through Zoom calls. And, I'm a very tactile person. I like to be in front of somebody and have a difficult conversation or a sensitive conversation. So I would say, as a leader, number one, you have got to practice an incredible amount of empathy. So you don't realize what everybody else is going through. We all come to work with our personal issues. This all figures into something called total worker health, which is one of the concepts behind the practice of industrial hygiene. Total worker health is all about all of the exposures that you as an individual have in your life, whether you're at home or at work, it's the same organism. And total worker health incorporates that what we call the psychosocial stressors in your life. And they're every bit as important and critical as being exposed to chemicals on the job or excessive noise or heat or repetitive stress. So I would say, as a leader, we're going to get into this. Emotional intelligence is a very, very important skill. And that's something that I started to get into about 10 years ago. And I studied it. And then I started to teach about EI to our chapters around the country and to student audiences as well. And I would also say that, again, having a level of comfort in having uncomfortable conversations is a challenge for all of us. I don't know anybody in their mind who loves having complicated, challenging, uncomfortable conversations, right? Very few people like that kind of a dynamic. But the way you approach the conversations and the way that you choose your words and the way that you actively listen speaks volumes to how you can be perceived as a leader.
Yeah, I could agree. A few things to pick up on. So first of all, like I've been on my journey of leadership for a while, and when I think back to early days, nobody even talked about things like empathy, emotional intelligence. You'd almost be like, are you kidding me? Right? And now there was an article or probably like a briefing, I guess, from Harvard Business Review on now that's a requirement. It's table stakes. Like if you're walking into a role like yours or mine, you one, have to have empathy, and two, EI is one of the most important skills because to your point, Larry, we're dealing with humans every day. And what's different, besides environmental things, is a lot of them don't have that separation because of hybrid. So there's a lot of positive, but the negative is if they have a challenging, stressful home environment, they're not leaving it. And they have no way to separate that. Whereas before, you could separate it. Whether or not that was healthy doesn't matter. But the point is, people now don't have that barrier or way to get away. And also, we're dealing with Zoom, and it's not the same as in person, and it takes a lot. Like I find myself sometimes, I have to train myself not to interrupt or not to, because you're so focused on what you want to say or whatever. And it's a lot of work. It's a skill, and like anything else, you have to constantly work on it and improve it, because culture is everything, and it's very challenging. So I'm glad you brought that up.
It is. I actually find these types of engagements on Zoom to be more tiring than if we were sitting down together in a conference room. I just love that, in-person dynamic. And I've been through, and I think a lot of CEOs have been through a lot of different types of personality tests, like StrengthFinders or Myers-Briggs, or there's the color code. And all of my analyses across all of these different protocols or paradigms leads me to understand myself that I am definitely a relator, and I'm a relator on an individual level. And that is really, really hard for those of us that are empathetic, that really try to understand the nuances of why somebody is saying or doing what they're saying or doing. And the Zoom is kind of like this barrier, if you will. It doesn't really provide that level of intimacy. So it is very challenging.
And you also never know who's listening in the background, like because of now backgrounds and staging. It's like for all you know, somebody's spouse or a friend or someone. And that's the other thing as CEOs, you have to be so careful because there's a lot of litigation around things like that. So you always have to be mindful of those things, which is important. But aside from that, that's really around the human and the empathy and the emotional. Let's talk about some of the other leadership skills you feel today's professional leader needs to have to succeed as we think about the future and the evolution of associations.
So obviously it goes without saying, but the relationship that the CEO has with their board of directors, and from the get-go, and I'm very fortunate that AIJ's got just an amazing governing body. I mean, these are very empathetic, sensitive people, but I think that's partly because of the nature of the profession. But what I started doing many years ago, and I think this dates back to before the pandemic, is that with the transition from board president to president, and we're on a one-year cycle, I started to host these biweekly calls, and the cadence is not really relevant. It's more the dynamic of having not only the president on these calls, but also the president-elect. And so once the new president takes over in the spring after our annual meeting, we invite the president-elect, the next president, to be scheduled into these regularly scheduled calls with me and the president. And they may not make all of the calls, and that's okay, but by the time that 12-month cycle is up, the president-elect understands the key dynamics, the key triggers, the key issues that are facing the association, and they can just jump right into the job very, very seamlessly. And so I'd recommend that a CEO really take stock in how are they communicating with their board leader, and could they and should they figure out a way to get that next person in succession into that ongoing dialogue.
I could not agree with you more. I think one of the most overlooked and important aspects of being a strong CEO is exactly that. You know, I have an executive chairman that I work with at my board, and every Monday we have a 30-minute call. Now, there's a Monday it might not happen because of his schedule and mine, but it's on our calendars, and it could be as simple as a check-in. It could be as important as monthly financials or what's going to happen at the next board meeting. But two things. One, we have a space to communicate outside of a broader room. And I also have him as a sounding board if there's bad news, good news, or whatever, and get some feedback, because no board member, especially a chair, ever wants to get surprised in a room. And it's a feedback. It's like holding yourself up to a mirror. And, you know, it's a real good discipline to do that. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I know from experience in looking around that successful CEOs have the support, because as you articulate there, we're all going to go through challenges. The support of your board is what makes the difference of survival or not.
Yeah, I would agree. And you know, everybody has their different ways of organizing their conversations, but we maintain this dashboard of conversations. It's just a simple Excel spreadsheet, and we list the various issues and then what the status of those issues are. And then when it's complete, we mark it complete. But we have a multi-year log now.
Oh, I
This is
love
going
that.
on like 8 years, 7 or 8 years, where we have a log of all of the issues that I have had the necessity to speak with my elected leadership about year after year after year. So there's this chronology, if you will, so that when somebody who steps into that role can look through those old notes to kind of get a sense as to the flavor. And these are the issues, as you know, that kind of pop up between those scheduled board meetings.
Yeah, no, I love that idea. That's one I have not used as a tool, and you bet you I'm going to do it. So thank you for sharing that.
And I'd say the other thing that I'll mention is that, you know, a lot of us as executives, we get a 360 evaluation from our direct reports. And I think that my association, you know, we love assessments because we're all about data and numbers. And so, you know, from the beginning, they asked that I subject myself to a 360 from my leadership team. And then on certain years, they wanted me to do it twice a year, which is quite a bit. But I said, okay, I'll do it twice a year. So they do it mid-year and then they do it at the end of the year. And they want to get a comparison on how the perspectives might change from mid-year to the end of the year. And we've tweaked the tool. We've used third-party tools. We've used in-house tools. We've done it whereby my coach has done phone screenings with my direct reports. So it's been more of a verbal intake as opposed to an electronic survey. But regardless of the tool and regardless of the methodology, when you get that feedback, which hopefully is sanitized, so you don't know specifically, you know, who said what, you've got to practice humility, because while you might think you're doing this outstanding job and everybody thinks you're just doing amazing, everybody's in their own world and people are going to put in these evaluations their perspectives and they're going to catch you off guard. And then you need to have a sit down with each person, with, of course, not knowing who said what. And then you share the sanitized feedback with everybody on your leadership team and say, in an aggregate, this is what I heard from you. And this is my game plan on how I'm going to address these areas of feedback, if you will. I don't want to say deficiencies, but feedback. And it's been humbling to me because I like to think that I'm a good communicator and that I'm very attuned. And I have done things that have just flummoxed some of my direct reports over the years. And then I get that feedback on the 360. So humility is a really important quality for all leaders to have.
Absolutely, because to your point, we're human, and what you think is reality in your mind can be very different. And it doesn't mean there aren't areas you're excelling, but all of us have areas of improvement. I've done them, we do them, and to your point, it's like you just need to be alone in a room the first time you're going through it, and then go, okay, now face the reality. So it's interesting. But thanks for sharing, because I think a lot of people are afraid of it, but it's a really good exercise, and it will help you strengthen and grow as a leader. So.
Yeah, and I'll say the one last thing that I'll add about this, because I think this is very critical, is, you know, a lot of us have performance bonuses that are tied to our contracts. And again, our board takes goal setting very seriously because we're very quantitatively minded. And I have shared my scorecard with some of my colleagues, and they're just like, oh my God, Larry, this is like 25 different goals. What is going on? And, you know, we do have a lot of goals for me, but, you know, I'm an engineer by training and I don't mind having that level of minutia because it really shows that the board is invested in success. And so there are a lot of goals that I have on my scorecard each year, and they're weighted differently depending upon the importance or the relevance of the issue. Some of them are a little more granular than they probably need to be on my scorecard, but I accept it. And, I kind of pick my battles, right? I'm not going to pick a fight on the detail on a scorecard when I have more important issues to focus on. And what's great is that everything is very quantitatively derived. We have stretch goals throughout my goal scorecard, so I can actually exceed the rating on certain goals if there's a stretch goal component. And when I have that conversation and setting the goals, and then later in the year when we sit down and evaluate my performance against the goals, it's just a very transparent, honest, and quite frankly, very enjoyable conversation because it shows everything that we achieved in the past year. And so I really enjoy the experience of setting and measuring myself against goals.
That's awesome. I love that. Well, this, as always, Larry, I always enjoy our conversations. This is no different. My favorite question at the end is to recommend a book that you would like to share with our listeners. We have such a great list. I have added so many to my reading list. So let's
Good.
hear what you got.
All right. Well, I have two today for you. One should not come as a surprise, but I have to mention the Daniel Goleman book, which is called Emotional Intelligence: Why It Can Matter More Than IQ. This is like the seminal book that was published, I think, in like 2005.
Yes.
And it's available on Amazon. And it's a great read because it not only introduces folks to the concepts of EI, it actually gets into the workings of the brain a little bit.
Yep.
And it talks about the amygdala and what the purpose of the amygdala is and the neocortex where the higher level thinking occurs and all of the kind of the neuron firings within the body. And so I recommend that book. And then the other one that I really like is called Thinking Fast and Slow. And that's by Daniel Kahneman. He just passed away. And
Oh.
that's about how the mind has two different systems of thinking, right? It's the automatic thinking, kind of like that gut reaction thinking, which ties into EI. And then that slower brain, which is you're taking time to analyze all of the factors in making your decision or taking a specific action. And so those two books are very related to each other because they really have to do
Yeah.
with how you react to outside stimuli.
Yeah, no, I read Emotional Intelligence years ago. It's always worth a refresh, but I like the other one. I have not read Thinking Fast and Slow. And I love that because it's pretty intuitive what it says. So I'm going to pick that up. Larry, again, thank you so much for your time, your insights. It's always a pleasure meeting with you. And I really enjoy it. So thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Appreciate it as well.
Thank you for listening to the Association Advisor Podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. To join our monthly newsletter, go to associationadvisor.com or just click the link in the show notes of this episode. Don't forget to follow us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast so you won't miss an episode. See you next time.